طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر. تسكله ماسا لون وطن، تسكله ماسا لون وطن، نفقا لعودة اللاجئين.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine is produced by Despina Mitsouris, and this is your host, John Roberts. It is difficult to see any positive gains in the Palestinian struggle to counter the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The military repression, land theft, settlement expansion, mass incarceration of young people, and continuing humiliation perpetrated by Israeli soldiers to the old as well as the young at the checkpoints is a constant drumbeat that we hear and bear witness to every day as we read news reports coming out of the West Bank and Gaza. But there just may be a light at the end of the tunnel. It is a challenge to the occupation by the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS. Today we feature a presentation by Omar Barghouti that was recorded at the Tree of Life conference in Cambridge on November 1st. It is a report on the status of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement that is gaining momentum throughout the world in astonishing fashion. The Boycott movement that challenged apartheid in South Africa was not successful until the movement was massively supported throughout the world. That is what is needed to make the Palestinian BDS movement successful, a worldwide movement supported by broad coalitions throughout the international community. What is making that movement move forward is the fact it is a non-violent movement that Israel does not know how to deal with. Israel's response to the Palestinian pushback is always militarily. It bombs Gaza, demolishes homes, and imprisons countless rebelling young people, kills dissenters with sniper fire, intrudes into villages and refugee camps with tanks and high-powered weapons. It knows how to respond with military power. But, as Omar Barghouti points out in this report, a nonviolent BDS movement cannot be bombed, cannot be imprisoned, cannot be snuffed out with sniper fire. Nonviolence is power that weapons cannot destroy, and Israel seems defenseless to its power, as was the government of South Africa. In the following presentation, Omar Barghouti reports on the achievements of the worldwide BDS movement. How is it doing? Is it achieving the worldwide support needed to be successful? You judge. Here is Omar Barghouti speaking at the Tree of Life conference in Cambridge on November 1st.
Okay, I'm so glad to be with you here. It's very tough to speak after Matt Gilbert's presentation, even for a Palestinian. It's very hard to speak. But I guess speak is what we must do, especially after that presentation, because we don't want you to get away from here just thinking that, you know, it's almost hopeless. Because that's not Matt's message. That it's not hopeless. It's brutal, but it's not hopeless. There's a lot of hope. So I'll focus in my presentation on hope. True, I was an activist in the anti-apartheid movement at Columbia University, and I'm very proud of that history, a very little tiny part of that huge movement. But it was the first moment when I learned how hope is important, because then everyone else thought it would never succeed. And actually, I was studying engineering, no one is perfect. And then the colleague asked me, do you really think apartheid will be abolished in your lifetime? And I said, no. So he said, you're Palestinian, why are you doing this? I mean, we have enough trouble on your own. I said, yeah, to me, it's a universal issue. Victory in South Africa would be victory for us. I'm doing it out of moral conviction. Even if we don't succeed, I feel profoundly indebted to the struggle to do anything to end Columbia University's complicity in apartheid. So I did it out of a profound moral obligation. And apartheid did collapse in my lifetime. And now I can take that hope. I'll start my presentation with Zeev Jabotinsky. For those who don't know him, Jabotinsky was the leader of the far-right Zionist movement back in the 20s, the Reform Zionist movement. And Zionists then were quite honest, unlike now. So, for example, they called it the Jewish colonization of Palestine. That was the term they used, because that's what it was. Zeev Jabotinsky wrote this very, very important paper, a little pamphlet, called The Iron Wall. So I'll just quote from Jabotinsky, he wrote that in 1923. It's very important for our message today. Jabotinsky said, it's utterly impossible to obtain the voluntary consent of the Palestine Arabs for converting Palestine from an Arab country into a country with a Jewish majority. He said, there's not one solitary instance of any colonization being carried on with the consent of the native population. The native populations, civilized or uncivilized, of course we were not, but anyway, have always stubbornly resisted the colonists, irrespective of whether they were civilized or savage. So he goes on to say, this is the punchline, every native population in the world resists colonists as long as it has the slightest hope of being able to rid itself of the danger of being colonized. That's why he suggested an iron wall that the colonized, the indigenous population, cannot breach. And that's an iron wall in the head to convince the native population that it's impossible to win. So give up and accept reality. Instead of thinking of rights, you start thinking of realities. That's Jabotinsky's genius, concept of the iron wall. So what we heard about the Dahiya Doctrine, what Israel is doing in Gaza, what Israel has been doing to the Palestinians for the last 6+ decades, has this iron wall as part of the pillars of the Zionist ideology. They want us to give up hope, first and foremost, and to accept colonization as a fact, as fate, actually. But the movement I helped to co-found in 2005, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement, is, I think, one response to this iron wall. Now, far from being hopeless and giving up, we're quite hopeful. We're quite optimistic. We're smelling a South Africa moment as we speak. And I think Israel's massacre in Gaza might well be its main undoing of its regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid. Today, John Kerry and Obama hint at BDS. Netanyahu mentions it 18 times in his speech to AIPAC. The Israeli government considers it an existential threat, and in fact, they openly said it's a serious existential threat, that they moved, a strategic threat, they moved overall responsibility for fighting BDS from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, June of 2013. Why did this happen? how can an initially small, non-violent, human rights-based movement become a security, strategic, major threat to a state that has hundreds of nuclear bombs, that is very powerful financially, economically, you name it, maybe that's you, your government. How can it feel such a threat from a non-violent human rights movement that's based on international law, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? It does not make sense. It makes all the sense. Nuclear powers cannot bomb a Presbyterian church when it adopts a divestment from HBO Catechism. What can they do when the Norwegian pension fund divests from companies involved in the occupation? What are they going to do to academics in the Asian American Studies or American Studies Association or African Literature Association or many of the other academic associations in this country that have adopted a full academic border of Israel? Shoot them dead. So that's the limit of Israel's power. And BDS really tests that limit. We found Israel's Achilles heel. The Achilles heel of that otherwise massive, invincible regime of oppression. We found its Achilles heel in the BDS movement. Nonviolent resistance of the type that we're doing is just penetrating through Israel's regime's defenses, and they cannot do much to stop us. I'll give some examples, especially after Gaza, or maybe in the last year, of some BDS successes, and then I'll go back to the origins of the movement, why we've launched BDS, some of the challenges we face, and then end with what can be done. Although I never preach what should be done in any place, because one of the main principles of the BDS movement is context sensitivity, which means any one of you knows best what can be done in Boston than I can. Because you know the context, you know the particularities, I don't. But I'll share with you some success stories, some experiences from around the world, and some of what we as Palestinians think should be done. But it's up to you to do what you can do. So, BDS had reached a tipping point even before the latest Israeli massacre in Gaza. And I'll talk a bit about that, and then I'll move to Gaza. Even before the latest massacre in Gaza, as I mentioned, academic associations in the United States, several of them have adopted a full academic boycott of Israel. And do not undermine this point. These are academic associations in the United States, not in Egypt, Bangladesh, or Brazil, where you have natural support for Palestinians. This is in the United States, where support for Israel is still much higher than support for Palestinians. So breaking that taboo at such a level in the academic ivory tower is very telling. It's very, very important for the future of the movement here. But aside from that, major academics from Stephen Hawking in the UK to others have endorsed a boycott, or at least heeded a boycott, of Israeli conferences, Israeli events. Many major artists have as well kept away from Israel. So Israel started feeling in the academic and cultural sphere like South Africa used to during the 80s, end of the 80s, when it started to feel really isolated. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. They know that, and we know that. But it wasn't just in the academic and cultural sphere. It's not just Irish academics adopting a full academic boycott of Israel as they have done in 2013. It's not just Belgian students, 100,000 members of the Belgian Federation of Francophone Students adopting a full academic boycott. It's not just that. We started hitting the economic sphere. And that 2014, this is this year, when we started to have a real economic impact. Even before 2014, we had some economic impact, but not so much as we're having now. So in 2014, we started seeing huge pension funds around the world, like the Dutch pension fund, the second largest Dutch pension fund, PGGM, divest from Israeli banks involved in occupation. Banks. We're not talking about little SodaStream, although I'll get to SodaStream later. Or Starlet. Now we're talking about banks affected. Yes, the impact in terms of dollars and cents is not huge yet, but it's Israeli banks being divested from by a European state pension fund. European pension fund. Very important. The Norwegians did as well. The largest sovereign fund in the world, the Norwegian pension fund, divested from several Israeli companies involved in the occupation. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, after an intense BDS campaign, had to divest from G4S, the company that Fosna is adopting a campaign against, G4S, as you know, is the largest security company in the world. It's involved in the Israeli prison systems, where torture is practiced regularly, in the checkpoints, in the colonies, in the occupied territories, and so on. So G4S is an excellent example of a BDS target. Bill Gates had to divest from G4S $182 million. And so did the United Methodist Church. And that was a very tough struggle. Those of you who are Methodists would know how difficult that struggle was to get the pension fund of the United Methodist Church to drop G4S. And there's a lot of struggle still going on for other targets. And of course, the Presbyterian Church, after 10 years of struggle, finally adopted divestment from Motorola Solutions, Caterpillar, and HP, which was a huge victory for every activist who worked on that in this country, within the church, Jewish Worship Feast, American Muslims of Palestine, AFSC, everyone who worked on this. This was a huge victory, and it took 10 years to get there. In Latin America, we saw 5 Latin American countries take some form of sanction against Israel, suspending free trade agreement discussions, pulling out ambassadors from Tel Aviv, or other form of sanctions, which is very, very important that this starts in Latin America. We also saw some companies starting to pull out of Israel, quietly, without much of a fuss, but they're doing it. And a company like G4S, I mentioned, at their AGM, the annual general meeting of their shareholders in London just very recently, promised that they will start to pull out from Israel, from the Israeli prison systems, completely, by 2017, they will end that phasing out of their business in Israel. Now, for such a huge corporation to admit that BDS is impacting its profits so much that they will start to pull out from Israeli business that violates international law is extremely important. We were not there a year ago. This is only 2014 that we're seeing this economic impact take place. So now, the BDS movement is taken much more seriously. And there are many, many other examples. I won't bore you with details, but there are many examples. And of course, on the New York Times pages, we saw an ad by 327 Jewish Holocaust survivors and their descendants, where they completely called to stop genocide in Gaza and called for BDS. And of course, after the massacre in Gaza, during the massacre in Gaza, Evo Morales became the first head of state to endorse BDS. The national executive of the National Union of Students, the British Student Union, which has 7 million members, something to envy in this country. They do have a union that has 7 million members of students, adopted BDS just very recently during the war on Gaza. Some Israeli companies started reporting major losses in their sales in Europe, especially Scandinavia, but not just. And of course, the famous SodaStream that said BDS was a nuisance, that got affected. So its share dropped by 72%. And has recently announced that they're closing down the West Bank Colony factory, finally. I guess nuisance can be very effective. And of course, we cannot forget the Block the Boat activities in this country. Community activists and dock workers, heroic dock workers in Oakland, California, blocked an Israeli ship, blocked offloading or loading an Israeli ship for 4 consecutive days during the massacre, and they repeated their action. And then it went to Los Angeles and Seattle and Florida, and it started to grow. It's not huge yet, but this is making history. In the United States, seeing Israeli ships being blocked for days on end is history. Several city councils in Scotland, Turkey, and elsewhere completely boycotted Israeli goods. Until now, it's ongoing. They said, we will not allow any Israeli products into the entire city. And this is happening in 4 city councils in Scotland, 12 in Turkey, and others. So we're seeing some sanctions, we're seeing some boycotting in all spheres, and we're seeing a lot of impact on Israel. This is why they're starting to feel that this is really a strategic threat to their regime of oppression. And we can see that going forward we'll have even more of an impact. This is why earlier this year the Israeli government had a special session to discuss a new strategy for fighting BDS, because their strategy clearly did not succeed. Since 2005, since BDS was launched, their strategy was based on propaganda, the brand Israel campaign. Send our artists and nanotechnologists and musicians and academics to show Israel's prettier face. That's exactly what they said in their propaganda brochures. It did not work. You commit a massacre in Gaza and then you send the Bat Sheva dance company, it doesn't help. People are not stupid. People can realize you're whitewashing. And South Africa did exactly that. So people are not stupid. People get it. So what is BDS? So I started from the reverse, where we are today. The Boycott and Divestment Sanctions movement was launched in the historic call of BDS in 2005 by the absolute majority of Palestinian civil society. This is one point that's always forgotten in any coverage of BDS. So yes, our victories are being covered very well now, including the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN, but you don't hear much that this is the widest coalition in Palestinian society. You're left to think maybe this is some British leftist thing, you know, or some crazy Jewish activist out in California doing it. You don't get the fact that this is the largest coalition in Palestinian society, including all political parties, all trade unions, all women's unions, students, youth, farmers, academics, you name it. It's the largest coalition in Palestinian society leading the global BDS movement. So it's a Palestinian-led human rights movement, non-violent movement, based entirely on international law and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As such, it's an anti-racist movement. We reject every form of racism, including anti-Semitism, and we're not shy about that. We do not accept anti-Semites within our ranks. We do not work with anti-Semites. We reject every form of racism against every human being, regardless of ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, what have you, color, and so on. And this is very important for us as a movement. It's an inclusive movement. As one South African jurist said, this is the human rights movement of today. The world today, this is the main human rights movement of today. As South Africa, the anti-apartheid movement used to be in the 80s and 70s. Today, it's the BDS movement for Palestinian rights. So BDS calls for ending the three forms of oppression, the key three forms of oppression that Palestinians suffer from. The occupation, including the colonies, the war, and so on. And by that, we mean the 1967 occupation specifically. Ending, number two, ending the system of racial discrimination within Israel itself, which amounts to apartheid. And number three, the right of return for refugees. Denial of that right is the biggest injustice that Palestinians are suffering from. But it might be a bit, you know, troubling, it's inconvenient. Why do you have to focus on all of these three rights? Why can't you just stick to ending the occupation, which we understand, and it's easier to deal with? Because even the New York Times can deal with it. Well, we do not shape our rights according to what's convenient for the New York Times. Our rights are inherent in us, because we're human, and because we're equal humans, yes. And we deserve equal rights to all other humans. As such, we do not compromise our basic rights. As Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who's our biggest supporter in South Africa, once said, I'm not interested in picking up crumbs of compassion thrown from the table of someone who considers himself my master. I want the full menu of rights. And we won't accept anything less than the full menu of rights. Now, that's the first aspect of BDS. It's the rights part, which is not negotiable. Our basic rights are not negotiable. The very nuanced and selective and context-sensitive part is the tactics. The boycotting, the divesting, the sanctions. That's very context-sensitive. So that depends on what can be done. What we call for in Berlin is very different than what we call for in Johannesburg or Delhi. It's very different, because the context is very different. We don't change our principles, but we change our tactics. We modify our tactics according to a special particularity, a special context. So in Berlin, BDS activists tell us, we cannot call for a boycott of Israel. Okay, you can't, so don't. What can you do? They said, okay, we can boycott companies producing settlements. Great. We can vote for a military embargo. Fine. Whatever can be done, so long as no one tries to undermine our three basic rights. So you can boycott one particular country, we're fine with that, and we'll work with you strategically to achieve that. But do not undermine our rights in the process. So do not say, oh, we oppose that right of return for refugees, you know, that's too radical. Too radical for whom? It's for the 68% of the Palestinians who are refugees, that's their basic right, according to international law. We're not asking for them anymore. Palestinians are divided in three parts. About 38% are in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem. 12% are in the state of Israel as second-class citizens, and 50% are in exile. But even among Palestinians in the occupied territories and in Israel, there's a huge minority of internally displaced persons, refugees, who cannot go home because they're the wrong type, basically. Even in Israel, citizens of the state of Israel, the indigenous Palestinians, who've been ethnically cleansed during the Nakba and since the Nakba, cannot go back to their villages because they're not Jewish. So they're citizens of a state that does not allow them to go home when they have refugees, because they're their own type. So this brings the issue of apartheid, which is very, very important, and it's the least understood. So many people think if Israel were to end the occupation tomorrow, everything would be fine and dandy. You know, it won't. Israel will continue to be an apartheid state, even if it ended the occupation tomorrow. So, I'm sure if this is covered in the Boston Globe tomorrow, somebody will jump and say, see, proof. The BDS movement wants to destroy Israel. They want to wipe us off the face of the earth. But if anyone is sending a story to the Boston Globe, it's important to carry the context. No, we're not. We don't call for destroying anything. We're calling for building our rights, regaining our rights. We're calling for ending injustices. If ending an injustice is understood as destroying a system, what does that say about that system? If equality would destroy Israel, what does that say about Israel? We want equality. If somebody sees that as their destruction, well, you think about it. So that's the key point, that we cannot deal with just partial set of our rights. Now, aside from all the rights, how to campaign, how to do BDS is very important and it's very dependent on the context. And we cannot just copy-paste from any history. We're very inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement. We learn a lot. We continue to learn a lot through our contact, direct contact with leaders in South Africa who led the ANC and the anti-apartheid movement. And we're very much inspired by the civil rights movement in this country. We also learned a lot from that, from the Gandhi-led revolution in India. We learned from all of that, and from many others. But BDS is first and foremost a Palestinian movement that is rooted in a very long heritage of Palestinian popular resistance, which is hardly ever recognized or acknowledged, in the West, especially. So it's very important to remember that. So what can be done? As I said, what should be done is up to you. What can be done? Quite a lot. To keep hope alive is very, very important. To counter Jabotinsky's hopelessness is very important, not just in Gaza, in Boston as well. There's a lot of hopelessness about the ability of activists to change the seemingly invincible reality. South Africa was peanuts compared to Israel. I mean, Israel has the entire Congress in its pocket. South African apartheid never had that luxury. At best, they had a majority in Congress, but not 100%. I mean, you can't get Congress to vote on anything American 100%. They'll always disagree on it. It's only on Israel where you get this 100%. And you don't need me to tell you that your Congress epitomizes the corruption, the institutional corruption of politics. I mean, that this is the case study, the textbook study of corruption in politics is your Congress. So, do I call for, you know, write a letter, we heard a lot about, write a letter to your congressman or woman, with all due respect to other speakers, if you only have 5 minutes a day, I would not waste it on writing a letter to your congressman. Seriously, I mean, I would do that if I had the luxury of time. After I've done my basic activism, then, and I have, you know, the luxury of 5 more minutes, I will write a letter to my congressman. Just to keep nagging, to be a nuisance. Without much, you know, nothing will happen. but just to be a nuisance. But something would happen after we built the movement. That's what happened in South Africa. And Caroline knows much more about this than I. We, at some point, many people were hopeless, but we always kept the hope alive. And we kept building the anti-apartheid movement in this country, one church at a time, one union at a time, one student council at a time, until it became a mass movement. Congress people will not wake up and be moral. Don't even think about it. No way. I mean, that will happen, might happen in 2 centuries, but not today. What they will listen to is money or power of the masses. If they feel they might lose the next election, they will listen. So if we cannot bring up masses affecting them, they will not even respect anything we demand of them in any letter. So we can write 1,000 letters. If they get votes by hundreds of thousands, that's irrelevant to them. They've got to see the numbers or the money. We don't have money, so let's get the numbers. That's our strength. We don't have money, we have numbers. So we need to build the movement from the grassroots up. And then we can demand of Congress, not beg of them, not persuade them, thou shalt do what I tell you, otherwise you get kicked out of office. That's the only language Congress people listen to. Not, oh please, you know, it's immoral what Israel is doing. Yeah, okay. So what? It's immoral what they do in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Iraq, and Yemen, and everywhere in the world. This country has been built on immorality. So what are we preaching to Congress? To become moral? But that's not going to happen. We have to force them to do the right thing through our votes, through our numbers, by building the grassroots movement from underneath the top. So boycotting, it's important to remember, boycott is not just about companies. It can be a company that's profiting from the occupation. It can be just a company involved in other human rights violations. But that's important. But it's also academic and cultural boycott. So when Israel sends a cultural ambassador to whitewash its crimes in Gaza, it's important to counter that. It's important to stand up to that and expose it as a whitewashing brand Israel routine that Israel does after every massacre it does against the Palestinians or Lebanese or others. So it's important to do boycotting, but not as an individual exercise, because that's not effective. In everything we do, it has to be a community exercise. It could be a church community, a university community, a student community, women's community, feminist, whatever. As long as it's a community activity, because then it has a lot more impact and it becomes more viable. It affects other communities. Saying that, it's very important to remember that we've got to build cross-movement alliances and partnerships. We cannot do it alone. Palestine is not the only injustice in the world. There are so many in inner cities in this country. We don't have to go to Somalia or Iraq. I mean, in this country, in every major city in this country, there's so much injustice. So why should black activists in Ferguson give a damn about Palestine? Well, you ask them and they say, we see the connections. That's why we give a damn. That's why we need to build alliances, because it's the same oppressor. Our oppressors are so united that we must get our act together and unite. If we think about justice for Palestine as separate from other struggles for freedom, justice, equal rights, anti-discrimination in this country and around the world, we're not looking far enough. We're not looking with a vision to the future. We've got to build cross-movement alliances. Divestment, as happened with the Presbyterians, as should happen with every church. We need to clean the pension funds of churches and unions and associations in this country of investments in companies that violate our rights. And this is not a charity. We're not asking for a charity. And this is not an altruistic exercise. This is a basic moral obligation. You have a basic moral obligation not to be partnered in crime. So when we ask you to pull your investments out of crime, we're not asking you for anything heroic. We're asking you for something really basic. Don't share in a crime. It's not a charity, it's an obligation. And what Martin Luther King said about the boycott, at a very simple level, in withdrawing support for an evil system or policy, rings so true today. Withdrawing support for an evil system or policy is not heroic. It's a basic moral act that every decent human being should do, out of their own conscience. Not feeling altruistic, dropping every other cause I'm involved in to do this. No, you don't drop any other cause. This is a basic obligation that you do along with other causes, whatever your other causes might be. Sanctions, so it's not racist instead, it's B, D, and then S. sanctions come last. After we do a lot of boycotting, a lot of divesting, then we have some hope of pressuring government, city councils, up to federal government, to take action. Can we clean up city councils' funds or contracts from companies violating Palestinian rights? Yes, if we do it smartly. If we look at the connections, like Sahar earlier in the morning showed, G4S, which is involved in the trade prison systems, is involved in the war with Mexico. Can we connect the struggles? Can we see the connections between security companies in U.S. inner cities, Israeli prisons, and make that connection? So when we call for divesting from a company like G4S, we're not just saying for Palestine. And I think in Boston here, the huge success against Veolia, which was one of the biggest successes in the BDS movement, is very important to remember. It wasn't just the Palestine Solidarity activists leading that. Of course, they played a key role. But it was unions and Jewish groups and feminist groups and a huge coalition of groups, because no one likes their public transportation privatized. People hate them. Good, so let's connect struggles. So the struggle for Palestinian rights against Veolia would connect with other struggles. That's why we had this huge success in Boston, where Veolia lost a contract last year worth $4.24 billion, one of its largest failures ever to win that huge public transport contract. And where's Nancy? Nancy was somewhere. And Nancy was very deeply involved in many other activists, so you all deserve a big hand. And Veolia, as Nancy knows, just very recently lost two contracts in Kuwait worth $2.25 billion. And this was by the government of Kuwait. The government of Kuwait said, the city of Kuwait and then other government officials said, after receiving an appeal by the Palestinian BDS National Committee to divest from Veolia, and after investigating Veolia's involvement in Israeli violations of international law in the occupied territories, we decided to exclude Veolia from this and that contract and from every future contract until they stop their complicity in Israeli violations. So Veolia is finished in Kuwait. That's a huge victory for the Palestinians. So to end, because I'm interested in your questions and the discussion afterwards, so I must end. To end, I will end with something unconventional, I suppose. In his poem, Message to the Living, Henk van Brandvik, I'm not very good with Dutch names, a Dutch poet of resistance against the Nazi German occupation of the Netherlands during World War II, wrote, "And people giving in to tyrants will lose more than body and souls, more than body and goods. The light will be extinguished." End of quote. On Sunday, September 14th of this year, a few weeks after the end of the Israeli massacre in Gaza, and despite all the death, destruction, and trauma, hundreds of thousands of Gaza's children almost literally rose from under the rubble that much of Gaza was reduced to and went with enthusiasm to their damaged schools, carrying their dusty books and injured souls. Their eyes were shining with hope for a dignified life. BDS empowers Palestinians and worldwide supporters of a just peace to keep this hope alight. Thank you.
That was an update on the BDS movement by its leader and major spokesperson, Omar Barghouti. Given at the Tree of Life Conference in Cambridge on November 1st. We need to be heartened by that report. And just as at the national and international level, great gains are being made locally, and we all need to not only continue to support, but become a part of the BDS movement at the local level. There are various campaigns organized to carry the movement here in the Boston area, and successes are already being achieved. For instance, the giant French corporation Veolia has huge contracts with Israel. They are the ones building and managing, if that is the word for it, the massive waste dumps from the Jewish settlements that are polluting West Bank land. It is Veolia that built the new light rail system in East Jerusalem to serve the settlements, illegally built on Palestinian land. Veolia is working to privatize water delivery, not only in Palestine, but also throughout the world. And it is Veolia that had a huge contract with the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority to run the commuter rail here in our own backyard. That contract expired recently and was put up for bid. Local BDS activists began working many months before contract expiration to expose Veolia's sordid record to the media, the Department of Transportation, our governmental representatives, the public, anyone who would listen. They appeared at hearings, Department of Transportation board meetings, had rallies, and supported the Boston School Drivers Union, which was struggling against Veolia, which has the contract to operate the Boston School Transportation System. Veolia lost the multi-million dollar MBTA contract. Everyone who knew anything about the MBTA knew that Veolia had the inside track on that contract, so it was a shock to many, mostly to Veolia, that the contract was awarded to Keolis, another French corporation. As you heard in Barghouti's report, Veolia is losing contracts throughout the world, and thanks to some great work by local BDS activists, they lost their contract with the MBTA, an absolutely huge success story. And local organizers are supporting the boycott against SodaStream, an Israeli company whose manufacturing plant is in an illegal settlement industrial park in the West Bank. Because of the boycott, SodaStream sales are dropping dramatically throughout the world, and its stock market value is plummeting, as Barghouti reported in his BDS report. Jewish Voice for Peace has given this local effort a giant boost with its organizing energy. Also, a local group of activists a couple of years ago organized a campaign to boycott Israeli marketing of Sabra dipping and Tribe hummus. These companies are being targeted because they financially support the Israeli military. That effort is a bit complicated because there is a local hummus provider whose name is also Sabra, owned and operated by a Lebanese family in Norwood, Massachusetts, whose hummus is fabulous, and that hummus brand is clearly not being boycotted. So if you see a Sabra brand with green trees and green print on the label, good to buy. It is the Sabra dipping company with red print that is the target. Confusing? Come on, you can handle it. Buy green Sabra hummus. Boycott red Sabra hummus. It's that simple. That organizing effort continues as slowly local markets and stores are deshelving Tribe and Red Sabra hummus. It is these local campaigns that have added up to an increasingly successful BDS movement. Now, a relatively new organizing campaign is developing locally, spearheaded by the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. The state of Massachusetts, as a result of several trade delegation trips to Israel, led by Governor Patrick, is entering a relationship with the giant water company Mecarot to work together in the developing field of water technology. And of course, the major goal of corporations who are getting into the water technology arena is to gain profit from the privatization of water. The Boston Alliance for Water Justice has been monitoring this process in Massachusetts and will be working to expose and oppose the move for corporations to privately control and profit from a resource that should be publicly controlled and available to everyone worldwide. This week in Palestine, we'll closely follow these movements, and in the weeks ahead, we'll feature some local organizers to talk more fully about these local organizing efforts. The BDS movement is building, and the local campaigns are looking for support. So think not only of boycotting Israeli products, but become a part of this exciting movement. That is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computers at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday Morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our full archive of past broadcasts, browse to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.